Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to the Early Morning Sunday Show. We are on our last slot, which is the Conscious Consumer with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the Jamiatul Ulama, the Economics and Finance Desk. Mufti, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. And jazakallah for having me.
Well, we're looking at a novel way to fund tertiary education. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm really curious to know because that seems to be one of the issues making headlines at the moment, with students complaining about registration fees and historical debt and that, all of that.
No, this is a recurring problem, as you correctly mentioned there. This issue of students having to fund tertiary education, which is, in the case of South Africa, becoming so increasingly unsustainable. And I think we find ourselves in a very precarious situation, in the sense that many individuals either cannot afford tertiary education or go through tertiary education and incur massive amounts of debt in the whole process. What further compounds the problem is that the individual maybe successfully graduates and completes the pursuit of education, and then you find themselves subjected to black tax, where they're having to service the student loans that were taken out in the past few years, and also having to support maybe a household of some sort, or maybe parents or siblings, and some so you find the individual is sandwiched in a very difficult situation, having to balance the specific needs of the household together with servicing the student loans. So this is a problem that is known to most individuals in our country in terms of how tertiary education is panning out. Surprisingly, there's a novel concept that has come about, and I was just reading about this week. It's a crowdfunding platform that has been created for individuals to tap into for funding their education, and for individuals who are willing to provide assistance and financial help to individuals who require such funding. So just to simplify it, crowdfunding has been around for a good few years now. In many other parts of the world, it is much more successful than South Africa. And in simple layman terms, crowdfunding is basically a method by which individuals with surplus are connected to individuals with deficit who don't have. So individuals who have wealth are given an opportunity to make their surplus wealth available to individuals who need it most. But what happens is, for individuals who have the surplus, many a time, you don't have the time, you don't have the knowledge, the expertise to sift out worthy recipients or worthy deficit units of your surplus money. So what happens is, the platform provider basically does all that basically homework for you and provides you with a finished product of where you can allocate your resources. Now, in the context of education and our topic for discussion, this method of funding, the specific crowdfunding platform we're talking about is called Phoenix. I'll spell it as F-E-E-N-I-X, Phoenix. It's a website, and I'll just quickly describe how it works, basically, for individuals who may be interested. The reason why crowdfunding becomes so important is because of how it basically is so closely aligned to Islamic ways of doing things. Islamic finance is also very much in support of how crowdfunding operates. So let's go through how it works in terms of the specific example of Phoenix. After the student has registered on the website, their profile is verified to make sure that they are indeed a bona fide or legitimate student. The student creates a profile in which they provide information like how much money they need, what are they studying, etc. And they can reach out to their community, friends, maybe family, provided it's not a parent, individuals, businesses who can all contribute to that specific student funding goal. So that's on the student side. You apply, you create a profile, and your basic profile is made available on the website. It's screened by the facilitators in behind supporting Phoenix. As a contributor, you make your donation via the platform and receive your Section 18A tax deduction. Now, keep in mind that 5% of your contribution goes to administration of the platform. I must make this very clear. So anyone who is making a donation or is considering it, 5% of your donation goes to the administration. Only 95% goes towards the education cost of the individual who you are willing to support. The funds are paid directly to the tertiary institution, so the student never gets to handle the money themselves. This is a great way to ensure that funds actually go towards the student's education costs.
Yes.
Now, on this point, I just want to digress a little bit and provide a small technicality. It's a rather major technicality from an Islamic point of view of dispensing with charity. Number one is, if the charity that one is making is lila money, it's pure voluntary donation, in that case, there are no strings attached in terms of the ownership passing between the individual and the donor and the recipient. As long as the donor and recipient are well aware of the fact that all the money is going directly to the institution. That's fine. If an individual is donating zakat, then it becomes a slightly more complicated process, in the sense that one needs to make sure that the recipient of the zakat is first of all Muslim. Number two, that there is some kind of agency arrangement between the donor and the recipient, that we are appointing so-and-so individual or so-and-so institution as the agent to receive the money on behalf of the recipient. So I think even if this technicality is not understood very clearly now, I just want to make a distinction that there is a difference between whether lila is being donated or whether zakah is being donated.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. My personal preference would be to avoid zakah in this specific instance, purely because of the administrators of the website not being familiar with the rules of zakah. Phoenix is not basically supported by any Sharia supervision of any sort, so dispensing of zakah is problematic, or could be problematic. I must add that all outstanding debt that the student may be carrying is verified beforehand to make sure that as a donor, when you do make any advancement of money, there is no overpayment made to the specific student or even the institution itself. Students have to submit a fee statement from the institution when registering and creating their profile I talked about earlier on. This is all verified by Phoenix. Only costs on this statement are covered by Phoenix. Some costs that I mentioned on the specific statement are covered by Phoenix. These costs may include, like, maybe academic costs, accommodation, registered residences, and even textbooks. So that's basically how Phoenix operates. It's basically connecting the individual who has the resources to dispense with and the individual who is struggling to find those resources. As we know, we live in a world where it's difficult to match two individuals who have distinct needs. So on the one hand, the individual requires help to fund their education. On the other hand, you have an individual who may be willing to dispense and is also expecting some kind of maybe tax deduction or something of that sort. So there's a benefit on their end as well. And this is why it becomes meaningful for both parties to participate in the process or of such nature, or even any other crowdfunding initiative.
It looks, I'm looking at the website at the moment, and it looks very easy to use, and I think it's a brilliant idea. Something that maybe the Muslim community should look into as well, seeing that we have so many organizations that actually do this, and there has been this push to bring them together into one entity, or at least administered as one entity.
And it becomes much more easier through the process of technology, because,
yes,
as I mentioned, when you as a donor provide finances, the facilitator of Phoenix basically makes sure and eliminates that possibility of overpayments being made. So the room for abuse, even for students who may be leveraging off different institutions to have money, is eliminated now, because you suddenly find that the institution is clarifying that this account is now settled, so move somewhere else. I think when I look at the whole initiative as a whole, what I find interesting is, for individuals who have wealth, many a time we have the desire to contribute towards worthy causes. And finding that worthy cause is a challenge sometimes. And when you look at initiatives such as this, you find specific areas that you as an individual have passion in supporting. So if you find someone who's, if as an individual you find there's sufficient amount of a particular profession, and you feel, I don't want to support that particular profession, I want to go to something, maybe someone who's pursuing a career in agriculture, suddenly you find there's a vent for your particular passion of project that you'd like to support. So these are initiatives worthy of considering.
And I think also it opens up the student to organizations and big business at the same time, because recruitment, that kind of thing could also come from this platform.
Indeed. Apart from securing funds, Phoenix also makes it the potential for long-term employment opportunities for students is indeed very great, because you find donors can identify students that they want to donate to. Even though all communication between students and donors is facilitated through Phoenix, donors can receive progress reports about students after graduation. Should the corporate donor wish to get in touch with a student with regards to employment opportunities, this can be arranged through Phoenix. So that possibility or prospect of potential long-term employment is phenomenal. So the effect, really, this is how you find education becoming much more sustainable, because it's the education process which is supported, and also beyond the education process.
Yeah, I think it's really a good initiative, and Jazakallah Khair for bringing it to our attention as well.
I just want to clarify for students who may be accessing funds. The way crowdfunding works, please understand that students are not required to repay funds that they receive. Although Phoenix does encourage beneficiaries to pay forward by helping their peers to raise money. So if a student does enjoy some level of support from Phoenix, it will obviously be a moral obligation to pay back so that others can benefit from the same scheme.
I think that sort of started here at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, where some of the medical students who are further in their studies have decided that they would crowdfund. And I think it's hashtag I am a doctor. They started doing crowdfunding for those students who are owing money to the universities with regards to the historical debt or for registration fees, so that they could get more people. Because some of them have really fared well at school, but unfortunately, due to either financial constraints or not having received NASFAS or funding, they've haven't been able to register. So these students have gotten together and they've started a similar project. I won't say it's crowdfunding, but not at this level.
I think the concept of crowdfunding is permeating different forms of professions and many different avenues of public-private partnerships that are required. I think what the fear we have is we're seeing many more governments are now jumping onto the bandwagon and utilizing crowdfunding to settle national debt. The problem we have is, while it may be very meritorious for citizens in any particular country to support a crowdfunding platform of the state to settle national debt, the first problem we tend to encounter when governments jump onto the bandwagon is that national debt in most countries of the world is very, very unsustainable. Even a crowdfunding platform cannot support the level of debt that is incurred, first of all. Second of all, when governments raise funds through crowdfunding, the potential for misuse is immense.
Yes.
And this is why individuals need to step up and understand their role in utilizing crowdfunding for their own benefit, and to make sure that state intervention is not is eliminated as far as possible, because we need the state, but not in every specific sphere where we can manage on our own.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, and in particular with regards to the fact that corruption is so rife within countries at the moment, I think it's best, to keep this at the level that it is without having government interfere. All right, let's move to the next topic, and that one is the safest way to buy fragile goods. When you speak about fragile, is there a particular type? Because I know food would fall under this category, as well as a woman, I'm obviously thinking about dishes and that kind of thing.
Yes, I think let me just confine myself. When I talk about the safest way to buy fragile goods, I'll just confine myself to the aspect of not perishable items like your food items. I'm talking about maybe cutlery, maybe electronic appliances of some sort, which are fragile in the sense that they may be working at the time of buying it in a store, and then you come home and suddenly it's not working, So I think when it comes to buying anything fragile, any electronic goods, or even cutlery or something of that sort. The difficulty all of us have, or many of us have, is that when you do come home and you find that it's cracked or it's damaged, it's not working, how do you substantiate or prove that it is not working from the time I took it? You know, it's not in working order, because there's always room to say, you know, as maybe while you transported it from the store to home, you did something. As a consumer, you did something. You know, so the onus is on you for having it damaged, because it was working when we dispensed with it. You know, so there's always that room of inconvenience, and then that room for assuming that the consumer is the one who's guilty for having damaged the merchandise, and hence the store may possibly refuse to take it back, saying that maybe, let's take the example of an electronic appliance, that say we tested it, it worked, it must have got damaged while you were transporting it in your motor vehicle or your delivery service, whatever you use to get the merchandise delivered home. So there's always that room, and I think this is why I think one of the best ways that is touted on many consumer platforms is to consider viewing your fragile goods wherever you like, if you like to view it personally and with your own hands and your own whatever senses you want to employ to determine mm-hmm. the suitability of your merchandise. Do it on your own, but eventually effect the purchase online such that the goods are delivered to your door. And then when it is delivered, you determine the suitability of the merchandise at the time before the person leaves the door. And then, obviously, if it is working, you dispense and let the person go. So this one method eliminates that room for assuming that as a consumer or as a customer, you are the one who is guilty of the fault, and hence it is not working. Because I think the example I come across on some of the platforms is the aspect of the fragile goods, the electronic goods working at the time when it was tested, but then in the packaging process, when it's put back into the packaging that the item comes with, that's when sometimes store employees actually fall foul of how they package back and damage in that at that time. So you saw it in working order, and then not realizing that when they packed it away, it was damaged in the process. Or while they were delivering it, it was damaged in the process. So I understand buying some fragile goods online from the start is a bit difficult. That is why I say it may be an option to consider viewing it in the store, but then buying it online, and when it is delivered, test the item before allowing the delivery person to walk away. And obviously, if it's working, you keep it. If it's not working, you notify them immediately. It eliminates that level of anxiety when having to explain oneself.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice, especially when we're buying online, as you said. It's almost like when you say that, it's like cash on delivery. You only pay for something after you've checked it once it's been delivered to you.
Yes, definitely. That's precisely what it translates to.
Okay, because I think a lot of the times this happens. Like, for instance, sometimes, you know, you buy an item that comes all packaged and you leave it aside and open it maybe 2 days later, only to find that the screen, the touch screen's not working, it's cracked. You don't know who, you know, where the damage could have happened, and it's your word against that of the business. So having it checked out, or having a witness, rather, when you open the package would also, I think, help.
Yeah.
So the person delivering, or the, you know, wherever you may be picking up the parcel from, because sometimes we pick up at a store that's affiliated to the company.
Yes. I think all of us, we are aware of things like the Consumer Protection Act, but as ordinary day-to-day consumers, we really don't have the time to pursue an aspect of law. And, you know, some of us have the time and the privilege of spare time to just to fight a case or to defend oneself, mm-hmm. but most times we're trying to eliminate that kind of experience, because there simply isn't time. There's so many things to do in a day, and the last thing you want is having to clarify some issue with a purchase you made, and it's taking months on end for it to be clarified in terms of the letter of law. So this is why the advice becomes relevant, and hopefully people can implement where possible.
Absolutely. I think that's very, very good. And people should actually be checking items out before you actually, you know, take possession of it. Have someone look at it so that you know that you have a witness to say that, yes, when we opened the package, it was already damaged. So it's not your word against that, the company or something like that. I think that's very, very sage advice. And then we onto our final bit of information, or the questions that we're asking when budgeting as a couple. Are we going to go through quickly through the list that we've done already, and then do today's last few questions?
Yes, definitely. Just to recap, these questions are basically meant for individuals to utilize, and for each couple, for each party in the couple to answer, and are meant to serve as a guide in terms of managing money. As I mentioned in previous episodes of this particular topic, that budgeting as a couple can work for some, it cannot work for others. But we need to find a balance of what works and implement accordingly. The whole issue is to not lose sight of the bigger picture. The bigger picture is basically assuming how to manage money. How we achieve that is it can vary between couples. Sometimes it can be through very, very explicit clinical communication. Sometimes it's rather loose, but it works. You know, in some respects, mm-hmm. It's loose, but it works. And each couple is unique in that regard. But let's go back to the questions quickly. And it's a surprise to myself, although we came to 12 thus far.
Yes.
So the first one was, do you feel that you can trust me enough to talk about our finances? And I mentioned, I explained why trust is the thrust of the whole issue. Number two, is there anything that I or you are doing that is contributing to our financial stress? Number three, That's referring to habits. Number three, what are your concerns about our finances currently? Number four, what would you consider a financial non-negotiable for yourself? Number five, what are the wants and needs that are important to you? Obviously, from this question, we're going to support the needs first and then the wants if they are sustainable financially. Number six, are they financially feasible for us? Can we afford them or not? Number seven, mm-hmm. What are your expectations of me? Each one needs to answer. Obviously, one needs to be ready to answer whether they are being selfish or not selfish in that regard. Number eight, where do you see us financially in X amount of years? Number nine, what are the possible solutions to the leaks in our budget? Can we identify practical and feasible ways to deal with those leaks? Number 10, what are all of our combined debts? Yeah, I mentioned writing them down. We need to make a list of actual debts and tackling the most important ones. So that becomes number 11, which debts are causing us the most stress and pressure in our relationship? And number 12, how can we support each other as a team in tackling our debts? Those are the 12 questions we've covered thus far, and the article is almost done, inshallah. It will be posted online very soon, inshallah. As soon as it is up, we'll notify our listeners via social media, inshallah. And I think we're ready for today's questions as a couple, which is probably the last segment of the episode, inshallah.
Okay, inshallah, let's go through with that, Lord, those questions. I'm sure they're pretty interesting. One of the things that I as you're going through the questions again, I realize that these questions with each other, I can see why trust is so important. And also the fact that you need to do a lot of introspection with yourself, because honesty is something that you, it's to yourself as well as to your partner.
Mm-hmm. Well said. The thing is, the honesty is definitely a non-negotiable in this whole process. I think it, as it goes with any other aspect of a relationship, it is more important when it comes to money. And the honesty aspect, there's simply no price to the value of honesty in terms of relationship in general and money more specifically. So that's correct. The epicenter of the whole thing is trust. And even if things don't work out, trust still has to be maintained, and people should not betray each other when it comes to things having not gone correctly, or they're no longer together, or whatever it is, but the financial aspects mm-hmm. remain. The trust has to be upheld throughout. I think for today, I just want to say, mm-hmm. the first question is, and this relates to the whole issue of what works and what doesn't work in a particular situation for a couple. So the question is, what style of communication do you prefer when talking about money? Now, why I'm talking about the style of communication is because we all react differently to how communication takes place. Sometimes being overly explicit and sitting at a table across each other can just create a bit of agony and anxiety. So while communication is key to budgeting as a couple, how you communicate about your finances is probably even more important. So I think let me rephrase the answer by saying that we should always approach our finances from the standpoint of using words like we, our, us. You know, those are key words that determine the success of how communication takes place. Because after all, as a couple, you are a team. You are not individual. You are a team. That's why the other person is the other half, because it's a team. It's basically a joint effort. So here are two scenarios to explain why the how is important than more important than the what and when of talking to your partner. So let's say you notice that there's some overspending on the budget for the month, and you suspect that it's because maybe say your other partner has been eating out more than usual. So you sit them down and say something like, we haven't been sticking to our budget this month. Are there any purchases that can explain how we've reached this point? Or how can we fix what happened this month? How can we fix what happened this month? That's one scenario. But now you compare it to the scenario where you say, you've been spending too much. You ate out 4 times this month. Can you please address it so that we stick to our budget? Now, you see a very big difference between the two approaches. So yes, the style of communication is important, because when it's approached as a team, and this is a fact of life, not only of money, at workplaces, when issues are approached as a team, you find the prospect of success is much more greater and much more promising. So that's the first question for today. And the last one is, would we, or let's say our finances, benefit from professional counseling, professional help? And I say this because many a time we find that some things are just beyond us as ordinary individuals. The bare reality of many issues that we face, it cannot be done by us, as much as they may seem discretionary and we need help from someone else. It's not something that you can just say, oh, it's discretionary and it's ordinary intellect you just use and you find a way. Like, you know, sometimes you need professional help, because the way things are evolving, and finances specifically, it's becoming a science as well as an art. So the science part is where you need the professional assistance. You need someone who knows the theory and has got a bit of experience, credibility, who can come in and provide a sane voice in terms of managing money in a marital situation. So professional counseling on money matters can help and can go a long way. And this is why you find many, like what we do at Economics and Finance Desk is provide basic help on what to do with money, how to do it, how to handle money, and on a very elementary level, because financial literacy in South Africa is not very good. The numbers don't speak, are not very positive in terms of financial literacy. People find a person could have gone through to matric, but they understand the basic theory of the mathematical calculations, but how it applies to ordinary life is often missed, and this is why some professional help may be necessary in guiding the couple towards successfully managing money together.
Okay, I think those are very important things that we need to look at, and there's so many that come up listening to you, you know, mention these questions and things that we should be doing. Really opens up the eye to, and you know, the mind to how important it is to be talking about this kind of thing.
Indeed, I think what I want to say in terms of in closing is that in a marital situation, there are many other things that need to be into over and above money. Money is important, yes, but parties in a marriage should never ever forget the promises they have made to each other to stay together through thick and thin, rich and poor, good health and bad health.
Yes.
Don't forget that that bigger picture is something that should never be one should never lose sight of. So being in a successful relationship is what should dominate the entire discussion, and one needs to be able to decide that's something that professional people cannot help. One needs to decide, you know what, I want to be in a marriage. This is where I rest my case, and I'll find another way to tackle my problem because I'm not winning. So I'll find another way to tackle my problem. But the bigger picture has to always be kept in mind of the promises that were made to each other to remain together and work as a team in managing a home together.
Absolutely. I think that's absolute advice that we need to take. So for anybody who is listening and embarking on marriage, make sure that you keep those questions in mind, as well as the fact of what Mufti has just said to us. The bigger picture is more important than just only focusing on finance. So Mufti, that's the end of today's show for us.
Barakallah. Jazakallah khair. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Jazakallah for making the time to be with us, and we appreciate it just as much. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.